Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Spencer Davis, professor of history at Peru State College. Dr. Davis will present the third in his four-lecture series on the topic, The American Civil War, a look back 150 years ago, which is being broadcast on the four Mondays of February. Today's topic will be A First Turning Point, August to September 1862. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, September 25, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Mick Hale, Director of Education at the Durham Museum.
Our guest lecturer for our third installment of this program, Dr. Spencer Davis, Professor of History from Peru State College. As always, we're very grateful for Dr. Davis and being involved and engaged with the museum. And he will take over from here, and I'm sure a delight, a thrill, and educate all of you this evening. So with that, I give it to Dr. Davis.
I'm prepared to educate. The delight and thrill, that's a pretty high standard, Mick. But thank you. We're going to start with a rather rapid review of the first 6 months of the year. We begin with really 3 months where the Union had notable victories, and some believed that a final victory in the war might be close at hand. Ulysses Grant won two victories that were important. One was at Fort Henry on the Tennessee River, and the second, actually close by, was a victory at Fort Donelson on the Cumberland River. These were important in opening up for the Union the possibility of getting really to the heartland of the Confederacy. And it's also where Grant got his nickname of unconditional surrender, those being the terms he offered. There seemed a momentary interruption when the Confederacy had an ironclad, the Virginia, and but its supremacy lasted only one day, and the Union's monitor arrived on the scene, and the Virginia had to withdraw. Shiloh was a two-day battle. Grant and his troops were surprised the first day, but they fought back the second day and took all the land they lost, and the Confederates had to withdraw as far as Corinth, Mississippi. And so, though this was a very bloody battle, in the end, it was another Union victory. And David Farragut led his ships past the defenses up to New Orleans, took New Orleans, and went up the Mississippi River. And by the time he was done, he'd gotten very close to Vicksburg, and the Union controlled most of the Mississippi River except for the area around Vicksburg. So these were very significant victories in the Western theater in the first 3 months of the year. The next 3 months, though, the tide of battle turned the other direction, and the Confederacy made a considerable comeback in the Eastern theater. In the Eastern theater, General George B. McClellan commanded Union forces, and he planned a really spectacular movement to take 100,000 troops or so from the Washington area by boat down to the Virginia Peninsula between the York and James Rivers, and from there have a rather short march to Richmond. The problem was that McClellan wasn't eager to take that final step of confronting the Confederate Army. At that time, it was led by Joseph Johnston. He was wounded, and Lee took command. And Lee was a much more aggressive commander, and he certainly understood that McClellan was not eager for battle. And psychologically, Lee had him beaten from the beginning. The 7 days battles in which McClellan backed down from the peninsula. Politically, things were happening in the Federal Congress. Two acts were passed that are important for the later parts of our story. One is the Second Confiscation Act, which was a more serious attempt to take slaves who escaped from their masters and declare them free and have them actually employed assisting the Union Army. And the Militia Act was changed by Congress to prohibit Union officers from returning escaping slaves to their masters. Again, it signaled that Congress was trying to do something to punish slaveholders for the war and to deprive them of the labor and service of their slaves. And so we've had this kind of roller coaster in the first 6 months of the year. In the second 6 months, the focus turns really to politics and what the Union will do about slavery and making the war tougher on slaveholders. Frederick Douglass, the great black abolitionist, demanded that the war be a war to end slavery. He said it was impossible to imagine a war against slaveholders that wasn't also a war against slavery. And he also advocated the use of black troops in the war, and he encouraged black men to volunteer because he thought that citizenship couldn't be denied once they'd been in uniform and sacrificed on the battlefield. And some of those same ideas were taken up by Charles Sumner, the Republican senator from Massachusetts, one of the radicals in Congress. He was probably, of all the people in Congress, closest to Lincoln, and he was urging Lincoln on to the same conclusion. However, Justice Taney, who is the architect of the Dred Scott decision, was utterly opposed to abolition. His sentiments really were pro-slavery, and it's said that he had already written a Supreme Court decision against emancipation. He wanted to have it ready as soon as Congress or the President acted to overturn what they did. So the political situation was complex, to say the least. Sumner, not bashful, he practiced his speeches in front of a mirror and polished them and thought nothing of delivering 3 or 4 hour speeches. And Taney, though still smoking a half dozen cigars or more a day, but nevertheless stooped and frail, a Marylander and philosophically a supporter of slavery. Here's Horace Greeley, the great editor, the most important newspaper man of the day, a Republican, but an extremely mercurial and inconsistent figure. And in the summer, he wrote this famous open letter to Lincoln, and he urged that the war be prosecuted, of course, as vigorously as possible, and that it be a war for abolition. And Lincoln had already been working on drafts of the Emancipation Proclamation, but his own open letter back to Greeley said that whatever he did about slavery, he would do to win the war. He knew what he was doing and the Emancipation Proclamation that he was drafting, but he didn't put all his cards on the table. And this has led historians to have rather different views of what Lincoln was actually doing. Here's a bit of military history, another disaster for the Union Army. Pope was brought from the West and given command in the East, a number of smaller armies put together. And he was full of confidence, announced he would fight a tough war, and that he and his troops from the West were only used to seeing the backs of Confederate troops. But that was bravado and an extremely bad prediction, because fighting at just the same place as First Bull Run, his army suffered a tremendous defeat and retreated back to Washington. His career was in effect over, and McClellan had to be again put in command. This was a substantial defeat. Lincoln had, in the meantime, spoken to his cabinet and told them that he had prepared an Emancipation Proclamation. And the Secretary of State said, "Wait till we have a victory. Don't announce it on the heels of defeat. It will look like desperation." And Lincoln agreed, but it took 8 weeks until there was a battle that fit the bill. The battle was Antietam. And this was a very improbable battle. Lee had lost his general battle plans. Some messenger had lost them. And McClellan was given these plans and knew that Lee's army was divided and that this was an opportunity to strike. But he delayed, and he delayed long enough that Lee found out. But nevertheless, Lee, knowing that his sort of overall plan was known to McClellan, decided to fight anyway. He thought McClellan was timid enough that he could still defeat him. That's a very considerable risk, and it was made worse by the fact that McClellan had twice as many troops as Lee did. Nevertheless, in Maryland, at Antietam, they did fight, and it was the single bloodiest day of the war. The losses of the Union were considerably more, 2,000 more, significantly more. But Lee retreated at the end of the battle and returned to Virginia. And that was enough of a victory for Lincoln to decide that he could issue the Emancipation Proclamation. There are some important things to point to in the Emancipation Proclamation. This is called the Preliminary Emancipation Proclamation. It was issued September 22, 1862. And Lincoln announces that on the basis of his war powers as commander-in-chief, he is issuing this, and that this is a preliminary statement. And in 90 days, if states in rebellion don't return to the Union, the final Emancipation Proclamation will be made good, and all slaves in the areas of rebellion will be freed. There are some things in here that need mention as well, though. One of them is that Lincoln repeats his offer of a federal compensation to slaveholders for their slaves. This is something that he'd been interested in, and he continued to mention it. Here's the mention of January 1st for the final Emancipation Proclamation. In here as well, he mentions acts that Congress has already passed. I think he's trying to point out that his action fits in with the powers that Congress has already assumed to deal with slavery. And so he mentions the compensation plan that he laid out before, and he mentions the acts of Congress as well This is a tremendous assertion of presidential power, but he's trying to put it in the context of previous initiatives and congressional action. It's true that it doesn't sound like his greatest documents. There isn't anything ringing about it. There's nothing majestic about it. It is legalese, but it's a tremendous change in the war. There are those around him who said, this is too dangerous, and after he had issued it, people high in the Republican Party, even the chairman of the party, Henry Raymond, asked him if he might not be willing to take it back. And abolitionists like Douglas and others feared that he would take it back. But he didn't. Having made it, he stuck with it. And this changed the nature of the war because it was now no longer a war to restore the Union, but also to transform the Union. It's often said that he ended slavery only where he couldn't do anything about it. But I think that's a severe misinterpretation. What he did actually free maybe as many as 50,000 slaves immediately who were behind Union lines. But what it did more consequentially for the 3.5 million slaves in the Confederate states is that it made their freedom a condition of the end of the war. If he was in the White House when the war ended, it would have to end on the basis of both reunion and emancipation. And so it became a sine qua non for the end of the war by the Union. And that was why it was important. And a tremendous change in the war. So there's our tour through these events. Two battles, one a huge Union loss, one a modest victory, but it's this tremendous political revolution that's the news of these 3 months and changes the nature of the war significantly, I would say completely. And with that, I'd like to turn to your questions about this significant episode in our Civil War.
The first question from the audience asked Dr. Davis to elaborate in further detail Frederick Douglass' criticism of Lincoln in regard to freeing only slaves already in free states.
Well, he accused him of timidity before the proclamation. But he took part in the great celebration in Boston on January 1st. And by then he was convinced Lincoln meant it and that it would be significant and go into operation. But up to that time, up to September of 1862, he thought Lincoln was a laggard, a sluggard, and politically timid. Yes.
Perhaps you could explain why he didn't free the slaves in the border states.
There were 4 states that had slavery that remained in the Union, the border states. And his view was that constitutionally he had no power to. The war powers only applied where there was rebellion or war going on. And since they were still in the Union, he couldn't emancipate slaves there. He also exempted areas in the Confederacy which he thought were peaceful enough, parts of Louisiana, for instance. But he did plan for a constitutional amendment which would eliminate slavery everywhere, the 13th Amendment. And it was in the course of going through Congress. It wasn't approved by the states until after his death, but for those 4 loyal slave states, emancipation came in the 13th Amendment. Yes, sir. The question is about the politics of keeping or sacking McClellan. The radical Republicans were fed up with McClellan. They thought that he didn't have his heart in the war. And in fact, he had given Lincoln a letter that said that under no circumstances should it be contemplated that the war would lead to the abolition of slavery. And this happened in July. It showed that he was not opposed to slavery, and many of his friends in the officer corps weren't. And of course, he was already mentioned as a Democratic candidate possibly for president in 1864 and had friends in the Democratic Party. So he had a base of political support, not so many Republicans, but he was popular in the Army, and he was popular in the Democratic Party. And Lincoln understood that he was the best of the Union generals at training the troops, which they needed desperately after some of these defeats. But politically, he wanted a kind of war of movement and a kind of soft war that respected slavery that Lincoln knew they couldn't win. It wasn't possible to fight the sort of half-hearted war that McClellan wanted and win. And so Lincoln was ready to fire him when he had an opportune time to. He waited till the 1862 elections were over. Yes, ma'am.
What exactly was his political calculation that the Emancipation Proclamation would promote him politically?
Would achieve.
Because almost everything he did was political.
Yes, and being president, it should be. I think it wasn't a nose count of people in the North so much as the feeling that the strongest supporters of the war were the abolitionists and the radical Republicans, and they wanted emancipation. And secondly, that to win the war, you needed soldiers and generals and politicians who believed in this hard war that included eliminating slavery. And a war fought on McClellan's principles of trying to minimize the harm to the South would never win. That was no way to win a war. And so I think that played on his mind as well. So it was the most vigorous supporters of the Union, and it was the need for a war that was fought with every tool available. He said that at one time, that he would leave no card unturned, that this was one of the tools he had, and he would use it to win the war.
What happened to McClellan after Lincoln's death?
McClellan was relieved of any command and went home to New Jersey. He did run in 1864 for president, but he never commanded again. He was in the Army, but he had no assignment.
What, once again, were the four border states to which earlier reference was made?
Maryland, Delaware, Kentucky, and Missouri. Whew. Put me on the spot, but I think I got them. They were considerable. Lincoln thought it was very important to keep them in the Union because of their population. He didn't want them ever reconsidering. And of course, Confederate politicians hoped, and Robert E. Lee in particular, hoped Maryland would join the Confederacy. And that's part of the reason he went into Maryland and fought at Antietam. So the border states were much on the minds of both Lincoln and the Confederate leaders. They're in an odd position for us to understand today, but their importance was understood by both Union and Confederacy at the time.
Was Maryland under martial law during the war?
I can't say the whole war, but it was at the beginning, because to get Union troops to Washington, they had to go through Maryland, and there was considerable opposition. And in Baltimore, there was this bottleneck of having to switch from one railroad to another, where Baltimore crowds were ready to attack. And Confederate sympathizers had burned bridges, railroad bridges, in Maryland. So there was a problem in Maryland, and for a time there was martial law. And I don't know how long it lasted.
What impact did the Emancipation Proclamation have on the foreign allies of both the North and the South?
I think it had a positive effect on the British. There were supporters of emancipation in England, but there were also pro-Confederate politicians, and Lincoln thought it would help sway the British to stay out of the war. And then whatever the English did, the French wouldn't go against that. And so it would keep them neutral as well. So its diplomatic effect, I think, did weigh on Lincoln. There are historians who believe it wasn't that important, that the British weren't swayed by it. But I hold to the more traditional view that it did have a positive effect on the British, and I think it's certainly true that Secretary of State Seward and Lincoln hoped that it would, expected it would.
Did that justice you mentioned make a serious effort to overturn the Emancipation Proclamation? That Chief Justice you mentioned?
Yes.
Did he make any serious effort to overturn that?
No, he didn't, and he died in 1864. But Lincoln thought a case very likely would come up. And there was a case that began in the federal courts over a slave from one of these loyal slave states that this slave had been had escaped and been emancipated by a Union Army officer. And he was a slave owned by the governor of Kentucky, as I remember, who wanted to make a big cause of it. And Lincoln invited him to the White House and said, I'll pay you the compensation for this slave so that this case doesn't proceed. And the governor said, no, I want the case. I don't want the money. But luckily, the wheels of justice ground slow enough that it was about 10 years before anything happened on it. But Lincoln imagined, and it was possible, that there could have been cases.
Can you go into some detail about the actual Battle of Antietam and how it was fought and how the tactics were employed there?
I'll do my best. Lee had divided his army, and he had sent Stonewall Jackson to take Harper's Ferry and then to return. And had McClellan moved quickly enough when Lee's forces were separated, they would have been so small that even he as commander would have surely won a sizable victory. But he took one day of sort of planning and another day of fortification and trench building, and by then Lee got his forces back together. And they had a conference, and There were those, as I remember, especially Longstreet, who thought that it wasn't wise to fight. They knew that McClellan had the basic strategy. But Lee overruled them and decided to attack. And the tremendous preponderance in numbers that McClellan had never came into play because he never brought them into battle. And he held almost all of his reserves out. And this seems pretty incomprehensible. So at the end of the day, there'd been tremendous losses, and the greatest loss, single day losses in the war, and Lee retreated. I mean, he was outnumbered something like 87,000 to 45,000, tremendous disparity, and he retreated at the end.
So is that why then it was considered a victory, just because he retreated,
yes,
even though the casualties were significantly
right.
higher?
He's the one who left the battlefield. Mm-hmm. In fact, the Antietam, the battle was on the 17th of September, and the Emancipation Proclamation isn't till the 22nd. And a couple of those mm-hmm. days were taken up in getting a beautiful, fair copy of it made. But Lincoln also waited because the news from the battlefield was a little bit contradictory. And he said, well, this isn't the victory I was hoping for, but it's enough of a win that it will count. So, yes, it was really Lee's leaving the battlefield and returning to Virginia that define it as a Union victory.
Some of the radicals said that McClellan was a traitor. Do you think he was a traitor?
No, I don't think he was a traitor. He had no contact with anyone in the Confederacy. That's going too far. He imagined that he should be president and that he would not fight the kind of tough war, and he certainly wouldn't emancipate the slaves. So he was utterly distinct from the Republicans, but the radicals went too far to say that he ever was a traitor. No, that's hyperbole, exaggeration.
Do you think McClellan could have defeated Lee if he pursued him after the Antietam battle? Got to him before he crossed the Potomac?
I think that day, if he would have committed his reserves, he had so many of them, that if he would have committed them, I think they would have won a very sizable victory. And Lee's retreat then would have been harder. I think it would have been. But, I mean, that's to make McClellan a different person than he was. That's why they were so mad at him. You know, it looked like what he needed was simple tenacity, energy, commitment. You know, Lincoln told him one time, if you're not using the army, can I? And so it puzzled them that he had their confidence, he trained them effectively, and yet when it came to that kind of commitment in the day of battle, he delayed, and it was incomprehensible.
That date of January 1st, was there any efforts ever to make that a national holiday? Now, that was the legal date, wasn't it, for mm-hmm. to free the slaves?
Emancipation. There were some who thought about that. But later on, a day called Juneteenth has been celebrated. That was when the news finally arrived by Union commanders in Texas of emancipation. And that's been settled on as a kind of informal holiday. Some states observe it as a legal holiday. But as a federal holiday, January 1st, 1863 wasn't. And there might have been, but it wasn't taken up. One reason is, I suppose, because the 13th Amendment sort of superseded it, and there would be a good claim that it should be the celebrated event. But that's a good question about what happened there. I believe it's the 19th. June 19th is celebrated.
When did the Southern congressmen and senators return to Washington and participate as part of Congress? Because as I understand it, a lot of these laws passed very quickly because they weren't there.
That's right.
For their votes.
The Southern representatives, all except Andrew Johnson, left Congress. And so that meant the federal Congress was comprised entirely of the border state and northern state representatives, and the Republicans were a huge, huge majority and passed all of this legislation. But their return, the return of the former Confederate states, was the process of Reconstruction. And it happened after the war, and based on how southern states approved the 13th and 14th Amendments, and then their representatives returned. Andrew Johnson wanted them to be back in Congress as quickly as possible and said that that was Lincoln's hope and plan as well. And Republicans in Congress resisted, saying they needed more proof that these states were actually loyal and that the elections there were fair and democratic. And that's that huge, long subject of Reconstruction.
We've been talking primarily about the impacts of the battles in the area, fairly localized in what areas they were in, as well as the political consequences. At this point, we're months now into the war. What impact was there on the general public?
Well, I think the war had a much graver impact in the Confederacy. They began to feel shortages, and of course they had to institute a draft law first, and so the sacrifices became clearer in the Confederacy, which after all had a much smaller population. In the northern states, the economy was still doing very well. There was a more animated politics. The Democrats had sort of recovered their confidence and were becoming more critical of Lincoln, and so there were political differences and sharply contested elections, and violently opposed newspaper editorials in the North. But the North was able to maintain a civilian standards of living really without any detriment and fight the war. So it had less. The losses in some of these battles, of course, were staggering, and there were families who'd lost loved ones, and Greeley and many others were thunderstruck by the severity of the war, and for that matter, so was Lincoln. But their ability to keep fighting and to remain prosperous weren't injured during the war.
Dr. Davis, the boss has requested me to ask you if you would explain that second handout.
Oh, yes. Ah, thank you. His boss, right here. Mrs. Davis. I found by accident this quote from Jefferson. I provided it because when we think about Lincoln's claim of powers as president in wartime, this seems to make the case almost in the very exact way that Lincoln did. And that is that the highest obligation of the president is to preserve the country and to preserve any one law and lose the nation would be insane. And Jefferson is not often thought of as the advocate of a strong presidency, but here it is. The case is made eloquently, and I don't think Lincoln knew of this letter, a private letter Jefferson wrote after he'd left the White House, but it seems to me to make the case of the emergency and wartime powers of a president. And as Jefferson said, this is necessary and also dangerous. And Lincoln understood that as well. Lincoln used another analogy about the powers of a president in wartime. He said, it's like a very powerful but bitter medicine. A patient will take it until he's sure he's recovered, but no one would keep taking potent and bitter pills after you're well. Well, he didn't know as much about addiction as we do. So this analogy isn't as convincing to us today as it was to Lincoln, but it suggests that he did understand that invoking a president's wartime powers has to end. It can't become a routine and regular thing. And presumably he would have disciplined himself as the war ended, and he did certainly turn to the constitutional amendment route of the 13th Amendment to replace the Emancipation Proclamation.
In what context was this written by Jefferson? Was it happened to be to his friend Adams at the time?
No, I think he's justifying his own presidency. And remember, towards the end of his second term, his embargo, and he actually used the army to stop New England merchants from either trading through Canada or sailing illegally to the West Indies or even to England. And so I think he was justifying his own conduct as president. So far as I know, this was simply a Virginia friend of his he was writing to, and I don't think it ever became a publicly available letter. It would have caused him trouble because he was more famous for believing in the limits on the presidency and the federal government than its powers. Yes, sir.
Wasn't he also sort of being chastised because he had purchased the Louisiana Purchase without the approval of Congress? And wasn't this letter criticism triggered by that?
It could have been. He left a diary entry, and he spoke to some of his confidants about the unconstitutional way of paying for and purchasing the Louisiana Purchase. And he said, oh, we should have a constitutional amendment. But I think this was a kind of a staged performance, sort of for himself, by himself, and to himself, because he quickly overcame it and went through with the Louisiana Purchase, and it's the great achievement of his presidency. But yes, had he been a consistent Jeffersonian, he maybe should have stuck with his qualms about the purchase. But it was such a good deal. Most Americans were in favor of it when it was completed. Yes, sir.
By this point in time, were the photographs that were being taken on the battlefields beginning to have an impact on public perception of the war?
Well, the war was an educational process, a sobering process for everyone, and no one knew how long it would go on or what casualties there would be. These armies were of unprecedented size. Losing at Bull Run had shocked many in the North. It turned out that wasn't anything like later battles. Shiloh was shocking. The losses were, I suppose, 3,000 maybe Union casualties and something like that for the Confederacy. And, of course, that was nothing like Antietam. And the sort of constant losses. And, of course, disease took more lives than combat. And so many died in camp. And the toll certainly mounted. Opinion went up and down in the North, judging by the newspapers, and of course the eagerness to volunteer went down, both in the North and South. And we know in the Confederacy the Army had to make sweeps periodically through areas where men weren't volunteering or weren't obeying the draft. And so war weariness and frustration, pessimism, were real and went up and down. Lincoln thought he would lose the election of 1864, that the public mood was very defeatist, and it was Sherman's victory in Atlanta really that turned public sentiment in the North. So there were waves of optimism and pessimism and frustration and conflict, internal conflict. And, of course, the South, by the end, was divided, deeply divided. And, of course, losing and rampant inflation and all of those problems made it far more serious. By 1862, some of this had begun, but it was much deeper in the next 2 years.
I remember draft riots in New York. Was that during this period, or was that later in the war?
It was a little bit later, in 1863. The New York draft riot, in fact, happened right after Gettysburg. And in fact, troops had to be sent from the Gettysburg battlefield back to New York City to restore calm. Yes, that was the most serious of these disturbances in the new in the North. There were others not so big against the draft law, but that was out of control for a couple of days. The New York City police didn't show much enthusiasm in quelling it, and Lincoln had to send troops from the battlefield to New York City.
Could you speak to Lee's thoughts about the reaction of the Marylanders when he went into Antietam to fight?
Mm-hmm. Lee believed that the majority of people in Maryland supported the Confederacy, and that Lincoln, by just skillful political maneuvering, had kept Maryland in the Union, but that when his army arrived, the people of Maryland would show their true colors and commit to the Confederacy. And he was surprised to find that they weren't so enthusiastic. He took supplies from Maryland. They took slaves, escapees who'd gone from Virginia into Maryland, but they didn't get that public wave of support that Lee was looking for. And I think that also played into his decision after Antietam to retreat and return to Virginia, because the political and public influence that he had hoped to have didn't happen.
When all these groups came together, did McClellan's officers replace the officers that came with these groups from the various states?
Well, after the war was going, they just threw them all together. There wasn't time for much training, and if they had trained at home, but there might not be much. That's why McClellan was important, because these were all green soldiers, and he could give them training and confidence, and it was necessary, because these were huge units, and once a battle began, it was incredibly important to retain discipline. But there wasn't the luxury of time to do that very much. The regular army before the war had been incredibly tiny, so there weren't very many professionals. McClellan had been in the army. He'd left it to be a railroad executive, but he'd been in the army, and there were others. And most of the important battles were led, both Confederate and Union armies, by men who had been in the regular army and were professionals and understood military life. But there weren't very many of them, and these were huge armies of tens of thousands of men. And so many of the officers weren't trained. A number of them were politicians, and they had very little military background.
Just a follow-up on the, we were discussing the drafts. How young were men being drafted in the Union Army, and what about the Confederates? How young were the men that were being drafted into the Confederates? Because fewer people in the South and men too. So I was just wondering about the ages.
I can't give you the exact age. The Confederacy changed the ages over time because they needed more men, and I believe by the end the Confederate draft was from 17 to 45, but I can't say for certain the ages. But they had to draft both younger and older men. The Union draft didn't change, and it was mainly a kind of incentive to get more local units organized and to get the states to send more troops rather than itself being the main way of getting Union soldiers. there was a kind of formula. The more you got through the state, then the smaller the draft number would be in the state. So it was a kind of carrot, or more like a stick, to get state enrollees. Thank you very much. I've got some books I'd welcome you to look at that are important on this topic. And if you have further questions, please come down and I'll answer them. But officially, I think we're going to be adjourned.
You've been listening to a program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Spencer Davis, professor of history at Peru State College. Dr. Davis gave a four-lecture series on the topic, The American Civil War, a look back 150 years ago, which is being broadcast on the four Mondays of February. Today's topic has been A First Turning Point, August to September, 1862. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, September 25, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Shauna Forsberg, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Listen next Monday, February 25th at 12 noon, for the fourth and final program in the series, The American Civil War, a look back 150 years ago. Dr. Davis's topic will be Where to Go from Here, October to December, 1862. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.